A Helping Hand, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. The California wildfires have forced thousands out of their homes. For many, the situation is desperate.
So you've got people living in the parking lot of a Walmart. You've got people who now are on their eighth day out of their homes, most of whom will not have a home to return to.
But amid all that suffering, there are also people trying to do good by helping others, like the taqueria owner in Chico who decided to hand out free burritos to evacuees.
Everybody was really appreciating that we were there for them, and they all say thanks over and over. They crying. They all was really appreciating that they can have a hot meal.
Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. The word apocalyptic gets thrown around a lot, but some of the images of the wildfires in California really do fit that description. Ryan Lillis reports for the Sacramento Bee. He's covered many fires over the years, but he says the one in the town of Paradise is the worst he's ever seen.
It's an entire town of 27,000 people. That's Paradise plus some other smaller towns in that area that have been completely or almost nearly completely destroyed.
For many of the survivors, Lillis says there's a sense of desperation.
So you've got people living in the parking lot of a Walmart in a tent city. You have people jamming evacuation shelters where there have been norovirus breakouts. You've got people who now are on their eighth day out of their homes, most of whom will not have a home to return to. And so there's just a lot of desperation.
I barely made it, even though my house is gone and my job is gone. I mean, I don't think I can go back. I mean, I don't know if my neighbors got out, so I don't think so.
I really never believed that it would come up as high as it did or eat all an entire town. The whole town is gone. I still don't know how to process that.
Voices there from the town of Paradise, as heard in an online video posted by the Sacramento Bee. Despite all that's happened, people like Jose Uriarte are shining some light through the heavy smoke. He's the owner of Gordo Burrito, a popular taqueria in Chico, California. Last weekend, Uriarte drove his taco truck to a fire evacuation camp in Chico and started giving away free meals to evacuees. Jose, first of all, describe last weekend to us. What did Chico look like?
Chico is like a war scene. Every street is busy. Everywhere, people with anxiety, they don't know what to do. So it's a horrible thing to see. But we kind of like getting used to because it's been more than 7 days. It is smoky constantly.
I want to know what made you decide to go out to this evacuation site and serve these free meals.
The taqueria is attached to a Valero gas station. And the owner of the gas station is my good friend. So he say, Jose, why don't we do something different this Sunday? And I say, what about it? Do you think we can go and serve free food to the people that is affected for the fire? And I say, I do believe it's possible. So I get a crew together, cancel my day of work on the taco truck, and decide to go to the places, and there's no money they can pay for that.
Jose, how did the people respond when you arrived there with all those tacos and burritos?
They all really appreciate it, and there's some people that is devastated and crying. I do believe it's my voice because I cannot hold the emotion, but everybody was really appreciating that we there for them. They take pictures. They all talk a little story, but everybody was really appreciating that they can have a hot meal.
Jose, I want you to bring us back to last Sunday when you were at the evacuation camp in Chico and you're there dealing with these people who've just been through a real trauma. Does anything stick out in your mind or any encounter with a particular person there when you were serving them and helping out?
This woman that came to me and say something about... I would like to have the who is the head person of this country and tell him that he cannot make America great without you, without people like you, she say. So this is something that really touched me because I'm come to the U.S. with nothing. And now I have a lot by working hard and I'm really proud of that.
I wondered if you're planning to go to the evacuation site again this weekend.
I do believe, yes, on Sunday we're going to be doing it again.
Jose Uriarte is the owner of Gordo Burrito, a popular taqueria in Chico, California. I want to thank you for speaking with us, Jose.
Thank you.
The fires raging through parts of California this week are just the latest in a wave of deadly fires to hit the state in recent years. Many people have died. Even for the survivors, though, losing everything when their homes are turned to ash is devastating. That's the case for Bernie Krause. His home and everything in it was destroyed in one of last year's fires. Krause spent decades recording the sounds of nature from all over the planet. Here's the world's Carolyn Beeler.
This is what it sounds like when a family of elephants drinks together from a marsh in the Central African Republic.
I've been recording these habitats for 50 years. I started in 1968.
The physical version of this recording once sat among thousands of others in Bernie Krause's home studio in Northern California.
Hundreds of reels of tape lining the walls and closets of that studio. And a lot of different kinds of equipment.
That recording of elephants was near this one. Of a summer breeding ground for migratory birds in Alaska. And this one of orangutans calling in a Sumatran rainforest. Over the years, Bernie Krause says these recordings have become a vast auditory archive of how humans are degrading the natural world.
Well over 50% of my archive comes from habitats that are either altogether silent or they can no longer be heard in any of their original form now. In other words, this is extinction of whole habitats.
Krause says that family of African elephants was poached. Climate change is transforming the Alaskan breeding grounds. And most of the trees those orangutans used to swing in have been chopped down. And late one night last October, those recordings themselves, the originals anyway, were wiped out by a wildfire fueled in part by climate change.
When that fire started up, for the first time in my life, I realized that we were staring global warming in its malevolent eye.
The changes Bernie Krause has been documenting around the world had come home to his own backyard in Sonoma County. Krause first spotted last year's blaze through the glass in the front door of his house.
And I thought I was seeing the reflection of the television set, but it wasn't. It was the whole hill outside our home that had just burst into flame.
The 10-acre plot of oak trees surrounding Krause's house was on fire.
There wasn't any place that we could look that we didn't see the fire. It was spontaneous and everywhere.
Krause and his wife drove over melting asphalt and through a wall of flames to flee. They felt lucky to escape when 43 others were killed. But their house and Krause's studio were incinerated.
I lost 50 years of notebooks. All of the metal on the reels of tape melted. It was gone. It was just gone. It was obliterated. It was all ash.
One complete copy of Krause's archive survived. He'd stored it in France just months before the fire. But today, the flames are again closing in on him. The deadly Camp Fire is about 120 miles away from the place he and his wife are renting in Sonoma. As he speaks to me from a makeshift studio in a bedroom, smoke is hanging over the house and surrounding vineyards.
We can hardly see the ridge line, which is about a half a mile across the valley where we live. Excuse me. And I'm coughing from the smoke.
The sun burns a dystopian red.
It's a very eerie kind of reddish orange from sunrise to sunset.
And Krause especially has noticed how quiet it is outside. Last year, he recorded a typical fall evening in this part of California. I asked him to step outside a couple nights ago to record a comparison.
Okay, I'm in the house right now, and I'm going outdoors. Normally there's hundreds of crickets out here vocalizing, but not tonight. Not any night since these fires.
The birds and crickets are silent in the smoke. Does it feel sort of like deja vu?
Yeah. But I'm getting a lot of that. Every time I go out into the field now, I get examples of that.
How so?
Well, I see the habitats changing. When I go back to them, they're subtly changing in some places and radically changing in a lot of others. And that's where I am not optimistic.
He's not optimistic that a lot of people will link these fires in their minds to climate change, even though scientists say they are related. California is warming up and drying out.
But I am hopeful in the sense that there's some young kid out there who will have an idea how to get some serious action about eliminating the use of fossil fuels.
For now, Krauss and his wife are watching the fires and waiting.
We're just very alert. And if they get anywhere within 50 miles of where we're at, we're out of here. We're coming to live with you.
Their escape route is one single lane road. Their emergency bags are packed and waiting by the front door. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
When a U.S. city sees a rise in violent crime, it almost always involves guns. But in London, a recent spike in crime has involved knife attacks. That disturbing trend brought this response from top British government official Sajid Javid. First, he said he wants to expand the police force. And second,
if the police think that there's good reason that they may be carrying an offensive weapon, the police should be absolutely empowered to stop them.
You've probably heard the expression stop and frisk. In the UK, they call it stop and search. And that's what British officials like Javid want more of now. As with the US, the policy is controversial because it raises huge questions about how it affects people of color. Nick Glynn is a retired London police officer who now advocates for police reform. When we spoke with you last, we talked at length about your experience as a police officer and that you yourself were wrongfully stopped and searched 31 times. And you attribute it to being a black man in a new car. Is that your concern about using stop and search around the knife crimes?
I think the problem with simply asking officers to do more and more stop and search is that they will make mistakes. So they will, if there is a blanket call for more stop and search, black people and Asian people are more likely to be on the receiving end of that, A, because there is a perception that we, black people, Asian people, are more involved in crime, a perception, not a fact, of course. But and secondly, because in the areas where the police are more active, where there is deprivation, where people are not so well off socially, economically, again, we are disproportionately represented in those areas. And this is not to say the police are racist, are discriminating. This is more an issue of structural racism and how that works. And pushing out more stop and search will just exacerbate if we do this in the wrong way.
So I hear your concerns about using stop and search. What then do you propose for addressing this rise in knife violence and for making stop and search effective yet fair?
I think if we're honest, then we don't turn to stop and search for the solution. And like I say, that's what's been done many, many times before, and it doesn't work. What is needed is a multi-agency approach to knife crime that starts, you know, in the home, in schools, and the health service in terms of the data that they can provide and the advice that they can give people. That's not to say stop and search doesn't have a part to play, but even in what the police do, there are many other things that they can do targeting organized crime groups because this is that's where much of the knife crime comes from, but with a different approach to just the sort of gamble or the guess, if you like. They're much more likely to be caught if the police focus on the things that are driving the crime that they're involved in.
Nick Glynn is a retired British police officer. He's now working on police reform across Europe through the Open Society Foundation. Thanks a lot, Nick.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. The Syrian city of Raqqa was under the control of ISIS militants for 3 years. It's hard to understate the group's brutality there. There were public executions, and women were essentially erased from public view in the city. Last year, a U.S.-led air assault routed ISIS and left much of the city completely destroyed. Richard Hall visited Raqqa recently. He reports for Britain's Independent newspaper, and my colleague Marco Werman spoke with him.
Rich, Raqqa was the former capital of the ISIS caliphate. When you drive through the city today, what do you see?
You can just see rubble everywhere. You see collapsed buildings, destroyed buildings. there are things that you can't see as well. So the electricity is still out in most of the city. Most people just use generators and they go out at night. Water still hasn't been delivered to most areas of the city, and it's still in ruins pretty much.
All right, let's come back to that anger in a second. I want to ask you about one of the key people in charge of rebuilding Raqqa, a woman you met, a young engineer named Leila Mustafa. Tell us about her and what motivates her.
Yeah, she's really interesting. She grew up in Raqqa, actually. So she studied civil engineering, and now she is the co-leader of the Raqqa Civil Council. Now, this is the council that has been put there by the Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces, who kicked ISIS out of the city. Obviously, she's from Raqqa, so she has an interest in rebuilding it. But she is a civil engineer, so she's an expert in rebuilding bridges, rebuilding homes, construction, roads, that kind of thing.
It's pretty extraordinary. I mean, in the years that ISIS ran Raqqa, they silenced women. They turned them into slaves. And now Leila Mustafa is in charge of rebuilding Raqqa post-ISIS. That is a wild turnaround.
It is, yeah. She's their immediate successor, you could say. And in every way, the complete opposite of what came before her. She's this very confident, outspoken woman who talks a lot about women's rights and the need to kind of change the mentality that allowed ISIS to come along. She's very impressive and very smart and very young, too. She's only 30 years old, and she's in charge of this huge city. And she just has an incredible challenge ahead of her. Mm. Like I say, the city is just – it's a complete mess. And no one seems willing to help or give enough help to really get things moving and rebuild the city.
The U.S. led the air campaign to rout ISIS. How does somebody like Leila Mustafa feel about the absence of the U.S. in rebuilding the city?
She's very diplomatic, in her words, as you can imagine, because she needs their help. The U.S. has paused funds for stabilization efforts in Syria. That's hundreds of millions of dollars. And Leila Mustafa and people in her position say this money is desperately needed. Now, the U.S. is tying this money. It says it won't give this money to rebuild Raqqa unless there's a political solution. So it's essentially holding the city hostage until the Assad government gives some concessions and agrees to some kind of agreement.
Are other countries filling the void, like Russia?
Not at the moment, no. No one really wants to get involved with rebuilding Raqqa and give them money to help them.
And what about families in Raqqa who lost their loved ones in airstrikes? What are they getting?
Nothing. The same. I spoke to a guy who had lost several members of his own family in an airstrike in the final days of the campaign. And I asked him whether he had tried to get compensation or anything from the U.S. He says there's no hope of that whatsoever. People who have had their houses destroyed aren't going to get any help to rebuild them from the international community. They don't have any hope of getting compensation for the death of their loved ones either.
Richard Hall wrote about his recent visit to Raqqa, Syria for The Independent. He's been speaking with us from his base in Beirut. Rich, thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
We're just days from the onslaught of the Christmas season and a staple of that time of year, the Nutcracker Ballet. One of the most famous scenes is when Clara and the Prince travel to the land of the sweets. That's where they meet the Sugar Plum Fairy and the other dancers who represent goodies like chocolate from Spain, candy canes from Russia, and tea from China. One of those scenes is now being updated by ballet companies around the globe. Mikko Niissanen is the artistic director of the Boston Ballet. Mikko, what scene is being changed and why?
It's the Chinese dance, or tea, because the ballet was originally created in 1890, and this was in a Clara's dream, how she imagined it, because one of the girls in a party scene got a Chinese doll, and it stuck in her mind, and now she's dreaming about it. So you can imagine how 1890s, a little girl imagining what is a China or Chinese people. And it is a very different story today when the world is so global. So in general, we feel like the characterization has, you know, it's been a caricature.
In what way was it a caricature?
There's a row of young girls, and they wear the sort of rice paddy hats, and the tilt of the head is a little bit too much, and we try to remove sort of the sticking fingers out and the facial expressions toned down versus sort of your classic rickshaw imitation from 1920s.
I'm wondering if the ballet always allowed for different interpretations to be made. I mean, I guess what I'm asking is, did the Chinese tea scene vary in appearance in Minnesota versus, say, San Francisco?
Well, now we're talking when the ballet came to the United States. The ballet was created like way, way before that. And yes, it's every choreographer does their own interpretation of it, but usually it's based on either the original petit pas or early Balanchine version. And, you know, those were very different times.
What about in your home country of Finland? You must have grown up with the Nutcracker. Traditionally, how was the tea scene performed there?
You know what? We didn't have the Nutcracker in a repertoire at all when I was a student, nor professional in Finland. So
really?
That's right.
Wow, why not?
You know, there it's a classical ballet that comes in a repertoire like Gisela Swan Lake every X number of years. And in America, it has become this Christmas staple.
What other ballet companies are modifying the tea scene?
I understand New York City Ballet has done something about it, Ballet West. But in general, it has been a topic for several years. And I think I'm glad that people are sort of being more and more considerate. So I think there's been quite a few revisions.
Are there ballet companies around the world that have also changed the Chinese tea scene?
To my understanding, this is starting in North America. I'm not aware of any companies in Russia nor in Europe that has done anything to it yet. But just wait. I bet it's coming.
How does the Nutcracker play in Asia? Any sensitivities, or is it simply as a celebrated ballet?
It's a very celebrated ballet, and there hasn't been any pushback. So it's interesting. But maybe in China and Korea, maybe there's not that much room for pushback in a society, period.
Have any other scenes in the Nutcracker needed modification? I mean, I think of the dancer representing coffee from Arabia, and there's often lots of stereotypes about Arabs. So I'm just wondering, are there any other scenes that if you look at them twice, you think, wait, not quite working?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you say that, because I'm taking one clap out of the Arabian dance to be, politically PC. The whole joke in my Arabian dance is that here comes this gentleman who seemingly seems to be totally in a control of the woman, but at the end, the whole real story is that he's totally wrapped around her little finger. But there's one clap that can be seen like his orders. He allows her to enter, so we've changed that a little bit. Otherwise, it's just a delicious dance.
Mikko Nissinen is the artistic director of the Boston Ballet. Its seasonal performance of the Nutcracker begins on November 29th. Thanks, Mikko.
Thank you so much.
I'm Carol Hills. This Texas businessman sells agricultural products to Iran. Things were going well for him for a while. Then,
when Trump took office, everything went backward.
How American sanctions on Iran are hurting U.S.-based businesses, too. That story, plus a Colombian locksmith who writes love letters on the side. All ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. What does Game of Thrones have to do with Iran's sanctions? The connection is Donald Trump. Let me explain. Earlier this month, as the U.S. was about to reimpose sanctions on Iran, President Trump posted a meme on Twitter. It showed him looking defiant, emerging from a cloud of smoke with a caption saying, "Sanctions are coming." That's a ripoff, of course, of "Winter is coming." Well, the sanctions have come. They're going to have a real impact on Iranians. And as the world's Shirin Jafari reports, some American businesses will also feel the pain.
When Iran and a group of world powers hashed out the Iran nuclear deal in 2015, Abdulrazak Kamyab was one happy man.
As a matter of fact, it helped my business.
Kamyab owns Imex Golf, a small exporting company in Plano, Texas, that specializes in food and supplements for livestock. He buys American supplements and ships them to Iran.
So I could help both U.S. economy and at the same time Iranian producers.
Before 2015, Iran was under U.S. sanctions. That meant trade between the two countries were limited. Kamyab had to get special permits to ship his products to Iran. But the nuclear deal created an opening, a rare chance for American businesses to sell to Iranians and for Iranians to buy American products. All of a sudden, Kamyab didn't have to jump through as many hoops.
I didn't need to renew my license required by the Department of Treasury if I wanted to export agricultural products to Iran.
There were also more shipping companies willing to go to Iran, he says, so he had more options.
The price of shipping went down.
Ruzbeh Ali Abadi, a business consultant in New York, says after the deal, he saw a spike in American companies looking to invest in Iran.
The real outcome from the nuclear deal was many companies wanted to actually capture this big market, this 80 million market.
A market of 80 million people, mostly cut off from Western products for more than three decades.
Solar panel companies, clean energy companies, water purification companies.
His advice?
Go to Iran, take baby steps. It will take time, but it is a good market for you.
The biggest business deal of all was the one signed by Boeing, says Dina Isfandiari. She's a fellow at the Century Foundation and at Harvard University.
It was a massive deal. They were, along with Airbus, going to supply the main Iranian carrier, Iran Air, with a whole new fleet of planes, which of course was much needed in Iran. So this was very, very significant.
The order was for 110 aircraft, with the possibility of 30 more in the long run. The price tag, an estimated $16.6 billion. Boeing predicted the order would create 100,000 new jobs in the U.S. General Electric jumped in too. It announced a $150 million deal for oil and natural gas equipment. And then...
Congratulations, Mr. President.
When Trump took office, everything went backward.
Kamyab, the business owner in Texas, says when President Trump walked away from the Iran deal, things began to fall apart for his business. The U.S. reimposed its sanctions on Iran earlier this month. And the sanctions specifically target the Iranian banking and shipping sector.
When the shipping company don't go there because of the sanctions and the money cannot be transferred to the United States, how can I do business or how can anyone do business?
So for now, Kamyab has stopped all shipping to Iran.
What happened is actually every business's nightmare scenario.
Dina Isfandiari of the Century Foundation again.
Because if you tell a business, okay, you're fine to go on, there's no risk now to go deal with Iran, and then, you know, a couple years later you tell them, okay, wait, now you can't do any business with Iran anymore, then that's exactly what businesses try to avoid.
And that's why Boeing and GE quickly ended their contracts. The Trump administration says the point of these sanctions is to punish the Iranian government. But Kamyab, the business owner in Texas, says they're actually punishing him.
My business is related to animal production. I don't believe stopping me from working is going to have effect on Iranian government behavior.
And he doesn't think the sanctions will hurt government officials.
They always find a way to have their best items on their table for lunch and dinner and breakfast. Look at them. You don't see any of them to be thin.
The ones who suffer the most, he says, are the Iranian people. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Venezuela is rolling out a smart ID card. The Fatherland ID, as it's called, transmits private data about the cardholder to government servers. And it's increasingly linked to food, health, and other government subsidies that Venezuelans rely on to survive as the economy tanks.
The government is very interested in trying to make sure that this kind of shrinking pool of resources goes to people that it can monitor, and in doing so, either reward or punish them to retain their support.
That's Angus Berwick, a reporter for Reuters in Caracas. He's been looking at how the Chinese telecom giant ZTE has been helping Venezuela develop this system. Beijing is well on its way to implementing its own system to track citizens' social, political, and economic behavior. I asked Berwick how the Fatherland ID card works for Venezuelans.
It's got a QR code, one of those, you know, pixelated bars, which is then scanned, and that then kind of uploads the data onto the database. There are several kind of benefits of the Fatherland card. The first benefit is that it gives you kind of monetary awards. For instance, like during the last election, activists that were working at some kind of like polling stands would receive bonuses, which are linked to their cards. On like Mother's Day here, you know, all mothers get a little reward as well. And then, you know, more and more what the government has been doing has been, you know, linking the card with key services here. So for instance, food handouts, medical aid, subsidized petrol, pensions, the services that the vast majority of Venezuelans need to survive. So for me, the kind of the two aspects that are more concerning are, firstly, voting polls have shown that a majority of Venezuelans did believe that their vote was not secret. During my reporting, I found that with the voting data collected in May, that state institutions have been kind of using that data to see which of their employees voted or not, which you know would have a big impact on the way they vote. And then secondly, if you don't have this card, and this card is, you know, to have it is almost a statement of support for the government. So you know, a lot of people in the opposition, they don't want to get it. And because of that, they're then denied access to services. So for instance, you know, I spoke with a 76-year-old man who's a diabetic who'd been denied insulin by a state doctor because he didn't have the card.
Now, how many Venezuelans have this Fatherland ID card?
So according to the government's figures, as many as 18 million have the cards, which is a little over half the population. I mean, government figures aren't always 100% trustworthy, but I mean, polls kind of carried out by NGOs and universities agree that it is in very wide use.
How did the Chinese company ZTE come into this? I know they developed this card.
So this sort of smart ID card has always been a long-term dream for the socialist government here. Nicolas Maduro's predecessor, Hugo Chavez, he'd implemented a program called Mission Identity. But it was only really in late 2007 when Chavez suffered his kind of first electoral defeat in a referendum. He realized the need to use identification more as a form of social control. It was then next year when he sent a kind of delegation of officials to China. From my reporting, you know, I spoke with a member of this Venezuelan delegation to China in 2008. And he said that was the first time that ZTE became involved. They met with ZTE executives and were shown smart card technology that ZTE was developing for use in China itself. And then kind of fast forward 8-9 years on, the Venezuelan government, it had initially started to develop the Fatherland systems with the help of a Cuban state company. I think the system it designed wasn't very secure. It had a lot of vulnerabilities. They then brought ZTE in to kind of revamp the system to strengthen it. And since then, there's been a unit of ZTE employees kind of embedded within the state telecoms firm here, working on the system and also developing an associated payment app.
In your reporting, did you get the sense that Venezuelans are worried about their privacy, or do they think that, you know, at least the Fatherland ID card gives them access to subsidies, so that's better than nothing?
I mean, we've been quite blown away by the reaction to our story in Venezuela. I mean, it seems to have kind of cemented a lot of people's fears about the government's intent for the cards and what they're doing with the data. But I mean, there are also a lot of Venezuelans who they might have worries about their privacy, but what they're more worried about is not being able to get their food handouts or their pensions. So I think they'd be willing to make that bargain.
Reuters reporter Angus Berwick in Caracas. Thanks, Angus.
Thanks very much.
Business is business, but there comes a time when ethics mean that it's time to reassess certain relationships. That's the case with some American universities when it comes to China. Cornell University recently announced that it was ending one of its partnerships with a major Chinese university after the school cracked down on student protesters. In a recent commentary for Foreign Policy magazine, Eli Friedman laid out a case for universities to take another look at their connections with China. Friedman is a professor at Cornell University's Industrial and Labor Relations School.
The way it works is, or the way it has worked, is that we send 8 to 12 students each year there for a short period of time in the summer. They go for about a month. And following that, in the fall semester, Renmin would send a smaller number of students, but for a longer period of time. The labor school there at Renmin is oftentimes considered the best place to study labor relations in China. And so by many accounts, it was a successful program.
And what's happened that has made you pull the plug on the whole thing?
So in order to understand the problematic actions that Renmin took, I got to take us a step back to June and July of this year when a labor conflict broke out at a factory in Shenzhen in southern China. Companies called JASIC Technologies, and they produce welding equipment. Students were coming from all over the country to support the workers. The police cracked down on this event, and all of the students who are currently enrolled in universities were detained briefly and then released. Some other people were disappeared, and we still haven't heard from them, and some people were given legal charges. When I saw that Renmin students were going and that the university was beginning to take some steps that I found problematic, then I began to pay attention.
What steps were the Chinese officials taking?
They sent messages to students that were mildly threatening, saying, you know, don't go to Shenzhen or don't go to Guangdong province. The thing that happened when I realized that something had to be done was when the university was complicit in the kidnapping of a student.
The kidnapping of a Renmin student who was an activist around these labor issues?
That's right. Her name is Yang Shuhan. She had gone to Shenzhen. She had been supporting the workers. After she was released, she went back to her parents' home, which is in Kunming, which is a city in southwestern China. The whole time she was there, she was closely followed by security agents. Then when she tried to go to the train station to catch a train back to Beijing to return to Renmin, she was detained against her will and essentially put under a form of extra legal house arrest. There were no legal charges.
Do you want Cornell to reevaluate all its connections to Renmin outside of labor relations? And are you suggesting that Cornell as a whole and other universities take a pause and reevaluate?
I'm not advocating that all programs need to be suspended. No, certainly not. I think it's important to stay engaged in China in some sorts of ways. But basically, since the student protest in 1989 in China, that of course ended with the Tiananmen massacre, once foreign universities began trying to re-engage China, there's been this acknowledgement that Chinese universities are in some ways fundamentally different from foreign universities. They are under the control of the Communist Party. The hope has just kind of been like, well, we'll sort it out down the line. And I think for a long time that was okay because China actually was in a period of sort of gradual, uneven, but, you know, gradual opening up. But what's happened over the past 5 years is a clear deterioration of academic freedom that is really quite serious.
How has Renmin University responded?
They've not responded to us directly.
How is Cornell responding to your call that the whole university really reevaluate?
There have been a lot of discussions, I will say that, within Cornell and with colleagues at many other universities around the world. There are as yet no other programs at Cornell that are taking the same steps.
In these recent months with the Jamal Khashoggi murder and Saudi Arabia kind of being the doghouse country that everybody's supposed to reevaluate, did that make you think, hey, everybody, there's other countries and let's look at China, too, that we're sort of not focusing on something that's right in front of us?
There's two separate issues that we have to keep in mind here. There's a question of the sort of more narrow sort of violations of professional ethics that universities are engaged in. And when those become such a severe problem that you want to disengage, and that's what we did. There's another question when, you know, the government is engaged in human rights violations on such a scale that the university has to make a decision to just disengage from that country altogether. And I think that with Saudi Arabia, we're more seeing the sort of the latter discussion, right, given their role in Yemen and then, of course, with the murder. We have not yet had that conversation about China, but China now has maybe a million ethnic minorities in concentration camps. So, you know, that might need to be a conversation that we begin to have.
Eli Friedman is a professor at Cornell University in New York. Thanks a lot, Eli.
It's been my pleasure.
We're off now to Medellin, Colombia, specifically to a suburb called Envigado and a small shop there where a locksmith somehow became the neighborhood's writer of love letters. My BBC colleague Clayton Kahn takes us there.
This shop once belonged to Humberto Restrepo. And back then, he wasn't just known for his locksmith abilities.
I would write a phrase, a saying, every day for 21 years. I never ever repeated one of the sayings.
Nunca, nunca se repitió una frase.
Humberto's rise to local fame began when he started to hang on a nail outside of his shop short inspirational phrases.
I would arrive at 7 in the morning. I would take down the previous day saying, and then I would pick a different beauty and hang it up.
Painted on pieces of white cardboard about a meter wide, Humberto would write out lines like, "One grows into greatness when one grows with humility." Or, "If you don't want to do good, don't do evil either." Many of the phrases were original, and some were borrowed from other authors.
It became an institution here. Students read them, stay-at-home moms, taxi drivers, business people. They would take photos, write the phrases down. People even called me many times to say, "I missed the day's phrase. Do you still have it?" Sometimes they would knock on the door and say, "Thanks for the phrase you put on yesterday because it helped me with our problem." It was a kind of breath of fresh air, an oasis in the middle of so much hustle and bustle.
Yet at the time when he began, Humberto's little shimmering oasis was surrounded by a reality much more complex than the typical stresses of urban hustle and bustle. It was the 1990s, and Medellin was practically a war zone, what Humberto calls the cruel times. The area was the center of Pablo Escobar's drug cartel and organized crime. Armed paramilitaries, guerrillas, and Colombian state security fought for control of neighborhoods.
I have lived through many tragedies here. They killed two of my family members in that cruel time, and it was very hard, very, very hard. I became absorbed by alcoholism.
Yet the humble locksmith was determined to not be vanquished by alcohol or the tragedies of the time. Even though he never formally studied past the sixth grade, he believed that his inner poet would be his salvation.
For
me, everything in life revolves around love. And love is born from pain. And here, we all know what pain is. And so as I continued to hang those phrases outside the shop, something strange started to happen. People would come and ask me to write them poetic verses for their significant others, their wife or husband, girlfriend, boyfriend.
Now, he was on a crusade to mend broken hearts. For a small fee, of course. He hung a sign that said,
I write love letters, speeches, and more for anyone in love.
Humberto's reputation as Envigado's lyrical cupid would permeate far and wide. At times, he had more clients that needed a love letter than a new copy of Keys to their home.
As I walk around Envigado, people always greet me. They call me cupid, poet, maestro. They call me all sort of things.
So Humberto, how do you do it? How are you able to adapt to each person so that the final love letter that you write is something original, unique, or special?
I use empathy. I become empathetic to the young, the elderly, the educated, the cultured, the doctor, student. I have an ability to adapt myself and put myself in their shoes.
On the other side of Envigado, on a quiet residential street, Humberto lives with his sister. He shows me his simple small room. He has very few possessions, but stacks of cardboard boxes. It is his archive of love letters that he has written over the years. He made sure to always have a copy. He pulls out one titled To Camila, a letter which shows the ethical consequences of pretending to be someone else.
At one point, a young man showed up and he said, are you the man who writes letters? He goes on to say, I'm horrible, I messed up, and she caught me. I love that woman. I told him that I would write a letter, but on the condition that he was to admit that he was very wrong and irresponsible in his actions, and that he was to apologize.
Humberto spent a day writing out the letter.
I shared the draft with him, and he approved. I asked if he wanted me to transcribe it on a computer. At the time, I had no idea how to use a computer, and so I had two or three people that would help me transcribe.
One of those people was a young woman, a neighbor of Humberto, who had a computer in her home.
I knocked on her door. I went in, and she turned on the computer and started writing. On the second or third line, she stopped and asked me who requested the letter. I told her that she knew all too well that it was against my ethics to divulge such information. That's when she started to cry. I asked her what was wrong, and she only said, No. She finished writing the letter, and I pay her and left.
Humberto admits that he thought it was a bit curious that the young man wanted a letter written to a Camila, and that his neighbor who helped him was also named Camila. However, he never suspected that it would be the same Camila. He says there are lots of Camilas in Envigado.
About an hour or two later, I get a call from Camila, and she says, Mr. Humberto, don't you see I told you? Told me what? I asked. That the letter was for me. And I said, why do you say that? Because the letter I wrote with my own hands earlier just showed up in my mailbox, she told me.
Humberto sees that it could be hurtful for people to find out the letters he writes aren't actually penned by a person's significant other. But he hopes people realize he's just helping those who have trouble articulating their feelings. He tells me Camila and her boyfriend happily got back together.
Not everyone has the ability to write, and there are times when one wants to say something but can't find the right words. that the most important part is their initiative and intention.
So you've used your letters to fix the relationships of about half of Envigado. But what about you? Have you used your own talent in your own romantic relationships?
I knew you were going to ask me that. I had a relationship once in Venezuela with an Italian woman, but it was brief. It was clandestine, prohibited, and hidden. However, I have beautiful memories.
So ironically, this master of romance has no romantic life of his own. The thing he loves is love itself.
Clayton Kahn from the BBC's Outlook program, reporting on the locksmith turned Cupid poet maestro in Medellin, Colombia. A sweet story to take us into the weekend. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. The World's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. Have a great weekend.
PRI, Public Radio International.